Well, how about we take your calls this hour with Michael Shermer as we talk about his life as a skeptic. One of his books is called Skeptic: Viewing the World with a Rational Eye. We're going to talk more with him about some of these issues and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Dr. Michael Shermer with us, and we'll get your calls as well as we talk about the world of skepticism. So what would you say, Michael, could be the biggest issue for a skeptic? God, afterlife, ETs, or is it all the same?
Well, the big ones I do think are God and the afterlife, because they, you know, they touch on the deepest questions of all. What's the origins of the universe? Where do we come from? Where are we going? What's the meaning of life? You know, they touch on those things, which is why religion, which is what religion's been doing for thousands of years, religion had a head start over other knowledge, forms of knowledge, to address those particular issues. And now science has begun to try to answer those questions, which is why there's this whole field, this science and religion studies, that is undergoing, because now scientists are starting to bump up against these ultimate questions. When, you know, Stephen Hawking writes a book about, you know, the grand design, he and Leonard Mlodinow now wrote that book, and, you know, there it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek title. There is no designer behind the grand design. It just happened, or we don't know what the designer is. I mean, that's their position, and but that's the kind of thing that makes people nervous, which is why I think when, you know, people say they don't trust science, it's usually on, they trust science a lot when they're, you know, sitting in a plane at 30,000 feet and, you know, typing away on their laptops, you know, checking emails, and all that works because of science. It's these kinds of questions, like, well, where do we go after we die, and where did the universe come from, and what does it all mean, that when scientists start poking around there and trying to answer the questions without God, then that makes people nervous. And, you know, I understand that, but, you know, it's okay. We're all in this lifeboat together here trying to figure it out, and we should use all the tools we have. And as I mentioned in the previous hour, you know, faith is not a reliable method of gaining information about the world, because our senses can't be trusted, our emotions, our feelings tend to be inaccurate, and you know, there's lots of studies showing this now, and so we have to have some other way of getting at the truth. And really, science, as flawed as it is the best methods we have. So, you know, we should try to apply that everywhere. That's my position. And all the other ones you mentioned, UFOs and things like that, they're, you know, super interesting. Aliens, possibility of extraterrestrial life, I would put up there almost with the question of God. Because in a way, as I mentioned, any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence would be indistinguishable from God. If you just think about what we've been able to accomplish just in the last century, scientifically, technologically, imagine a species that was 10,000 years ahead of us instead of, you know, say a century ahead of us. It would be inconceivable what they'd be able to do. It'd be like us with a dog or a cockroach or something. They wouldn't even know. Huh. We wouldn't even know how much smarter they are than us. We wouldn't even understand what we don't understand. It would be truly one of those unknown unknowns. It's unfathomable. This is one of the areas I think you've dealt with on the show, is, you know, artificial intelligence.
Oh, sure. One of the things, by the way, Stephen Hawking says will be our undoing is artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there's a great debate on that at edge.org, John Brockman's site, which he hosts these annual questions. One of them last year was artificial intelligence, should we be afraid or not? He has almost 200 different answers to the question from different scientists, and, you know, they're all over the board. But yes, there's a sizable cohort of scientists that think this could be the end of our species. You know, that if these computers gain artificial intelligence to the point where they can not just be smarter than us, but continue to accelerate the levels of intelligence they're able to gain beyond us, we wouldn't even know. At some point, we wouldn't even know how much smarter they are. It'd be like, again, asking your dog if he understands how much smarter you are than him. He wouldn't even understand the question. He's not even aware that, you know, that this is an issue, and that very well could be, you know, and it's hard to imagine, but that's the point. It's hard to imagine, and
it is.
That doesn't mean it can't happen. So it's a real, I think it's kind of conversation we need to have. I'm not jumping on the bandwagon of let's pass legislation that restricts people like Google and Apple from developing smarter and smarter computers, but let's just at least talk about it and think about it. You know, is this something we should be worried about?
One other area here, Michael, before we go to the calls for you, and that is religion. Do you think religion, I guess this is through the eyes of a skeptic now, was set up as an organized effort to control us?
Not quite so overtly. I would say it evolved more along the lines of how government evolved, just a way of trying to set up a system by which we can all get along relatively well, in tension with the fact that people on top that have the power want to keep it. And so they begin to use the tools and instruments of government and religion to control people. But I don't think it was set out for that at the beginning. I think it develops like that. It's how good people get into office and they become corrupt because, you know, power corrupts. I think it's something along those lines. And that is the thought about historians of religion. They look back to thousands of years ago with the rise of civilizations and writing and technologies. Religion was in there with government. And you know, the modern American idea of separating church and state, that's really new and still fairly rare. But it was non-existent before. I mean, one way to validate your rule is to make it a divine right. Well, I'm talking to God. He told me I'm supposed to be in charge here. Oh, okay. You know, how do you dispute that? You know, it's just a way. You're right in a kind of not quite the conspiratorial over. I think it just happens. You know, I think it just happens naturally as a way of consolidating power. That religion is a tool of that in a sense, but it also has other functions. You know, it's not just a tool of politicians. I mean, it does provide comfort and solace for people in their times of need and loss and grief and so on. I mean, we have to remember what a good life we have in the 21st century compared to how most people lived before us. I mean, life is nasty, brutish, and short, as Hobbes said, and boy, is it ever true. And religion is a way of, you know, helping people, you know, get through the night. And I recognize that. I'm not sure we need it the same level as people needed it in centuries past, but certainly it serves, you know, many different functions. And so, free parking.
Sure does. Okay, let's take the calls. You ready?
Yep.
East of the Rockies, BJ's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi there, BJ. Thanks.
I was wondering if matter is energy and energy is matter, and most physicists agree to that, then how does one, a skeptic, explain the 21 grams that escape the human body at the time of death? If your weight before the time of death and your weight after the time of death, do you have any theory on that?
They say, Michael, that you do lose a little bit of weight when you die.
That was one study done in 1906 by a guy named McDougall, based on a total sample size of 6. As you can imagine, these are hard studies to do. And the problem was that his weight scale wasn't very refined, and he couldn't account for the fact that you do if you stop breathing and so on, there's a little moisture lost, and not all of the 6 lost 21 grams. Some actually gained weight mysteriously, which again is probably just a measurement error. And the whole thing is measurement error. It's just hard to conduct that experiment. It's never been replicated. I don't think you'd ever get an ethics committee to approve that kind of study. MythBusters told me they were going to try to do it, but I don't think they ever got approval from the networks to do that. So that turns out to be a myth. That there is no such evidence of 21 grams, even though it's become this meme that gets passed along. But if it turns out there's a soul, we're going to have to find it somewhere else. It's not going to be in, you know, the measuring the weight difference. If there is a soul, it wouldn't weigh anything probably. Although I don't think there is such a thing.
The fact that you are a skeptic, has it changed your views on life?
In the sense that yes, it has. In the sense that I feel I really need to make a difference, make every day count, make my relationships that I have more meaningful, and you know, try to help to make the world a little bit better place, be a better person, because this is it. There is no, this is not a staging area for the play that's going to start in the next life, where everything really counts. This is where it counts right now, and I think that's a worldview everybody should have anyway. Because whether there's an afterlife or not, whether there's a God or not, shouldn't we be doing those kinds of things anyway? You know, being nice to people and trying to make the world a better place, and you know, pretty much everybody agrees. Yes, of course, right? Okay, so then, what do you need religion for? What is it offering other than hope that there's an afterlife? But, you know, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Don't worry about it. Just try to make the best of this life now. And that's what happened when I abandoned my religion.
All right, next up we go to St. Louis. Norm's with us. Hey, Norm, go ahead.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Good to see you. Good.
I had a pretty miraculous event happen in my life back in the 80s. I think it might shed some light on the existence of God. I'll try to condense this, but I was having problems with my wife, and anyway, I opened up my Bible, prayed for a while, went to the bank, got a little money out. I was headed south to Florida, wherever. I just had to get away. I got about 100 miles out of St. Louis. My truck started overheating. It never overheated in 2 years. I opened up the hood. The carburetor was on fire. I kind of freaked out. I walked down Highway 55 a little ways, climbed up a bluff. After pleading with God to give me an answer, I ended up out of exhaustion. I passed out on top of this bluff. I woke up about 2 a.m. with a big dog licking my face. Okay. And it scared the hajibis out of me, and I scared it. But it woke me up. I climbed down off the bluff. I kept walking south a little ways and to exhaustion, and there's no cars out. I'm pleading with God to give me an answer, you know, what to do. Basically demanding God to answer my question. I finally couldn't walk no more, so I went across the highway, and I'm walking back towards St. Louis in maybe a mile, and a truck pulls up. A guy waves over to me as an 18-wheeler to get in the truck. I kind of cautiously went. I picked up a brick just in case. He says, "You don't need that." I get in the truck. He starts driving. He never really said much of anything except, "You look like you're having problems," or whatever. We get about 20 miles before we hit St. Louis, and he pulls the truck over. I kind of reach for the brick. I didn't know what was going on. And he says, "You don't need that." He looks over at me, flips the dome light on. He says, "Norman, I have an answer for you." Now, I'd never told this guy my name, so I got all the goosebumps and my hair stood up.
I bet. Jeez.
He says he came from and the exact words out of his mouth was, "The Lord Jesus Christ sent me 2,000 miles from Spokane, Washington to give you this message." He gives me about a half hour prophecy about reconciling with my wife. I'm going to have 2 sons. He gave me past details of my life, et cetera, et cetera. Now, just to kind of stop it there, as that's not enough. But in church circles, they call it a divine appointment, but you were talking about hitting the lottery and everything, but the amount of things that had to happen, whether my car overheated, whether I didn't go to the bank, I prayed a certain amount of time, all these things for that guy to come from Spokane, Washington, and I'm exactly at the mile marker, is probably beyond 100 times of what it would take to hit the Powerball.
I love
yeah,
that.
Indeed, that's quite a story. But of course, we have to wonder, you know, what if you hadn't been there? I mean, this guy was driving. He was driving for Spokane for some reason. I mean, doesn't he have a wife and family? What's he doing? Why is he? Where's he heading? I presume he's a trucker, and he was going there anyway for some other reason. Not just for you that he didn't know. I mean, people don't just aimlessly drive around looking for lost souls.
Well, he had to be, he either, I've thought back over the years, and I'm thinking he's that could have been an angel. God says he sends angels as strangers, and it was either that or he was very close to God himself, and then, you know, God gave him the message, and he stopped what he was doing and headed to St. Louis to give me this message. I don't know exactly which it was, but I just know it happened.
Yeah, I understand, and that people have unusual experiences like that a lot. Some of them are life-changing. And you know, all I would say was I'd say you're probably the beneficiary of a kind, generous, giving person who, you know, turned out to be Christian, but he could have been some other religion and also been just as helpful. And perhaps you'd be, you know, thanking, you know, a different person or a different religion for helping you. It doesn't have to be Christianity. There's a lot of good people of other religions, and I think you were just the recipient of a good person. You didn't need the brick. You know, in some other instance, you might have needed the brick, and that would be unfortunate. But I would say, you know, count your blessings that you met a good person that helped you, and if that made your life better, okay, that's good. But I wouldn't know, personally, I wouldn't leap to the, you know, the angel or the supernatural intervention explanation, because of, you know, all the truckers driving around out there, all the people that are, you know, moving about the world, doing their thing, and then, you know, somebody gets into trouble. But, you know, you hear these stories pretty much every day on the news of, you know, the Good Samaritans, people that
help,
and that's a good thing. I think it's a sign of our human nature, the good side of our human nature, that we have to remember. That I reminded people in the moral arc that, you know, hey, there is a good side. We're not just evil. We're also good. And there's a lot of people like that. 10,000 acts of kindness that really mostly go unreported. You know, the news, the media is not in the business of reporting good things that people do. It's the business of reporting bad things, homicides and genocides and, you know, wars and conflicts and racism and so forth. That's what they do. So we have a kind of a distorted view of the world, but there's these 10,000 acts of kindness that happen every day, like the story we just heard, that I think is a testimony to our species, and we should look at it that way, I think.
Michael, of everything that's skeptical for you, what's the one area that you are, outside of climate control, bendable on?
Oh, I think consciousness is still one of the great mysteries. I don't really know. I'm not committed to that. I don't know what the explanation of it is. You know, the actual experience of feeling and thinking and being. I think that's one of the great ones. The origin of the universe, I really don't know. I just don't know. So I'm bendable to that. You know, what's the right theory or explanation? I don't know. You know, so there's a few like that that... And I'm open.
All right. Well, you hang with us. We're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls. So those of you from South Carolina, North Carolina, Idaho, California, and the rest of you calling in now, just hang in there. We'll be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, if you'd like to hit a little resort area and talk about aliens, come on up to Big Bear Lake in California. Full information at coasttocoastam.com under the highlights reel. That is my next major event with some great heavy hitters, including our dear friend Stanton Friedman. So come on up. Dress warmly, by the way. All my coats are in St. Louis. I've got to go get one for the L.A. area. That's crazy. But it's all there in the, oh, wait, by the way, it's the first weekend in February, so should have a great time. Welcome back. Dr. Michael Shermer with us, and your final phone calls. Fast night, Michael. Moves along with you, my friend.
Thanks.
Evolution. Where are you there? Are you a Darwinist, or you must be?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. The evidence for evolution is so overwhelming. It's one of the best theories in all of science. That we can be very confident. I mean, not just the fossil record, but especially all the genetic similarities between species. It's quite clear that we are all in this long lineage of evolution together, all animals and plants and so forth. So, I mean, in fact, to one of your other questions you like to explore on this show is, you know, possibilities of extraterrestrial intelligence and life. If we were to find a second genesis on Earth, that is a different set a different genome, a different kind of replicating molecule, something completely different than DNA. It would be as if there were aliens had visited, or life started twice on this planet. Paul Davies is the astrobiologist who's wrote about this second genesis idea, that you don't have to go to SETI and go to space to look for aliens. They might be here. We might just not be recognizing them. They may be of a different different kind of genetic code. Now, so far we haven't found that, but that's further evidence that evolution happened. Is that genetic continuity between all species?
All right, back to the calls we go. We go to Gary in Santa Maria, California. Gary.
Oh, thank you very much, George. I feel like a lightweight stepping in the ring with a heavyweight here, but I'm going to give it my best shot. My hypothesis is that astrology is based in dark energy and quantum physics, and I wanted to go farther than just concentrating on bean sprouts growing faster. I wanted something big. So with the help of the Coast to Coast audience, I did a little history checking on Monsanto, because emotionally driven intention is very powerful when you astrologically steer it. So on the Grand Cross in astrology, supposed to be the most powerful time, was on April 23rd, 2014. I went on the air and had people put out the intention, Monsanto stock down. It only dropped by a couple bucks. I was disappointed. I came back on.
You made the whole market drop. You're the reason.
Well, July 3rd, I did the same thing, referencing. Now, get this, I'm only speaking historical. I did the same thing because the Grand Cross, Jupiter moved out and the Sun moved into Jupiter's place. Now it's a solar charge. Grand Cross. I had them put out the same intention. It takes Uranus and Pluto keep their square or their opposition for 3 to 4 months. Between July 3rd and October 10th, Monsanto's stock dropped by $20 a share. Then I went on Coast to Coast with Lisa Gar, except her switchboard blew up. And she couldn't take my call. At that time, it was at the peak of the Uranus-Pluto square, and the stock dropped again, $13 a share.
They're going to nail you for stock manipulation.
I'm talking historical. Then I went on the air with Richard Serrett, May 22nd of 2015.
All right, I'm going to have to... Gary, I want you to get on point here, okay?
Okay, anyway, I did it 5 different times, all very public. Just go to Monsanto stock, zero in on the dates, listen to the Coast to Coast Insider replay. Those dates are exact. It's very public. In total, Monsanto stock on 5 different occasions dropped at least $10.
Yeah, but everybody's stock has dropped right now. It's been horrible for the stock market. So, Michael, what he's trying to say is that he was able to manipulate the market with his mind.
Right, yeah. Well, there's a lot of theories about the market, as you know. and people think they find patterns and fuels all the whole financial industry of people that get paid to do this. And astrology is just one of hundreds of different schemes, none of which work. In the long run, the best investment strategy is to go fishing. Just make your investment, ride it out, let the market do its thing. If you try to pick and choose the winners by whatever technique, astrological or otherwise, the chances of you doing any better than, say, the S&P 500 over a long stretch are virtually nil. Now, somebody will do better. And so here's that statistical effect we were talking about before. There was a famous hedge fund manager named Bill Miller who beat the S&P 500 14 years in a row. And he was declared by Fortune magazine to be the greatest hedge fund manager ever. And he made $1 zillion doing this and so forth. But what people forget is that there's over 4,000 hedge fund managers. And by chance, if you just roll the dice 50-50 every stock trading day or every year or whatever measure you want to use, by chance, you're going to get somebody, like the lotto winner, somebody's going to beat the S&P 500 14 years in a row. It's just going to happen. It just happened to be Bill Miller. He happened to be the lucky recipient of the streak, but it had to be somebody by chance. And that's the problem. The chance that you will figure this out, or me, are, you know, virtually zero. Well, one, you know, probably one out of millions to be able to do this. And so I wouldn't trust any of those techniques. And furthermore, I wouldn't pay somebody a lot of money to do it, because they really can't do it. You know, random walk down Wall Street. I forget the author's name, the economist that wrote that, but it's a great book, because it really shows the effects of randomness on the market.
All right, let's take a couple more calls, Michael. We'll go to Jeff in North Carolina now. Hey, Jeff, thanks for holding. You are up with us.
Hi, George. Hi, Michael.
Hi there.
Hi.
Michael, I'm a member of the Skeptical Society, and I enjoy your magazine a lot. My question to you tonight is, what do you think about the philosophy of transhumanism and the whole idea of the singularity as promoted by Ray Kurzweil in his book? Take a skeptical view of it. I think I'm. I like the idea of the singularity, but I'm skeptical it'll take place the way Ray Kurzweil says it's going to take place, especially in the next 50 years. I'm very skeptical about that. But what's your take on that? And do you have an issue devoted to that?
Yeah. Well, we're working on one, and I just my column in Scientific American that came out today online. Go to cyan.com and read it. Is on the very subject. I call it afterlife for atheists. And the kind of stuff we were talking about earlier, you know, what's the soul? It's the pattern of information that represents you. Well, what the transhumanists and the singularitarians want to do is basically upload that brain, or freeze that brain, or store the information that's in that brain somewhere else that can last longer. Now, what Kurzweil is proposing is that we can't do this yet, so you have to keep the blob of protein in your skull going for a few more decades, 2030, 2040 maybe. He's projecting that this could happen. So you got to eat well and diet and exercise and take vitamins and all that stuff he does. But I think he's over-optimistic. Like George, we were talking about AI. You know, when is all this going to happen? I don't think it's going to happen 2030, 2040. I think it's more like 2130, 2140.
You think that far out? Huh?
Yeah, I think it's further. I think it's a harder problem than most people realize. I've been following this since I was in college. You know, this idea of when will computers achieve human level intelligence? You know, we're 5 years away. We're 10 years away. And I think we're always 10 years away. It's still like that. It's, you know, like your local sports club. You know, they're always 10 years away from being world champions. So it's just a hard problem. And I think I like those guys. I like Ray Kurzweil. I'm glad people like him are working on it. Because, you know, maybe my skepticism is inappropriate, and maybe they'll do it. Well, okay, great. I'm happy to take advantage of the benefits, and I hope they can achieve it. I just think it's a much harder problem. You know, this connectome thing, this is not like the genome. You know, the genome was a hard problem. They were saying it was going to take us a century to do it, and they did it in 10 years. This point Kurzweil makes. So, you know, it's people like Shermer say it's going to take a century to do the connectome and all that. You know, maybe it'll just be 10 years. But the connectome, every single connection in your brain is many, many orders of magnitude more complex than the genome. Way, way, way harder and more complex, with far more interactive components in the system. And, you know, to duplicate that is really hard. Now, I'm on this a brain preservation prize committee. It's a $100,000 prize for preserving a small mammal brain. By preserving, I mean preserving the connectome. That is, you fix the animal's brain, and then you freeze it at minus 130 degrees centigrade, and then you bring it back up to room temperature, and then you slice it in a scanning electron microscope, and then you see if the synaptic connections are still intact, if the molecules are still in the synapses, if the parts of all the neurons are still in place, or have they been shattered from the freezing process. And a lab just did this. They just did this last week. They're going to win this prize. I don't think they've announced it publicly yet, so I won't say who it is. But the people that are judging this, you know, through their electron microscope, can see that they can't wake this animal up. The brain, you know, the brain is sliced up. Okay, but the idea would be, like, if you could do this in principle, then in practice, you could take a brain, fix it, you know, a dying brain, say fix it, freeze it, and then bring it back. Say,
reinstall it?
Yeah, reinstall it or reanimate it centuries from now when we have the solution to the problem that killed you in the first place. This is the idea behind cryonics. Now, the people that have been frozen today probably won't be brought back. But you never know. I mean, again,
You never know.
So that's the transhumanists. You know, they want to go beyond human, which mostly involves implants and transplants and computer interfaces with the brain. Well, we're already doing this. You know, with cochlear implants for hearing, for example.
Sure.
That's a computer interface with a brain in a way. And so why not take that in principle and expand it to, you know, everything, your eyes and,
Well, they're getting close with that.
And that's right. They are. So all that could happen. But still, that's different. Is that preserved? That's still keeping you going. And maybe you could expand it from 120 years, the upper limit, to 150 or 200. But if you're talking about living thousands of years, then there's probably not going to be any biology involved. You would essentially replace all your parts to the point where there's no longer any original you. Well, that's the case anyway, because your atoms are being replaced. But no protein meat, no electric meat. It's all computer. In principle, I think this is correct, that if you did this while you were still alive, the continuity would be in place, and you, George Norrie, would wake up tomorrow and it'd still be you. You'd still go, yep, me. I think. even if you were 100% silicon chips, I think it would still be you. But you know, this is
maybe
a hard problem of continuity.
Just maybe. RB's in Idaho. Go ahead, RB.
Yeah, my guys.
Hi.
That sounds like the Flatliner Society.
It does.
Whatever, you know, I think just a little perspective. All the human activity for however many millennia, we still can't make a single cell that lives from the elements.
Nope.
But whatever, and
we're not
fella called from his truck. I mean, he was relating what we would refer to cannot be scientifically explained, i.e. a miracle. Now, he had a miracle happen in the middle of the 19th century, and two brothers were murdered because they related that miracle, and there were 11 other witnesses. And sometimes we forget there were those 11 other witnesses that talked of such things of angels appearing and this sort of thing. I mean, and we just brush it off. I think we can have it educated out of our realm, essentially. I think you said that, you know, when you went to graduate school or upper division or whatever it was, and you became a greater skeptic. But at the same time, miracles happen and they're witnessed. And these witnesses gave the details of angels appearing and all this sort of
thing. Well, and they become, in some cases, RB, saints. They get sainthood. Michael, we're out of time, my friend. Keep in touch. Any speaking engagements coming up for you?
Oh, just now I'm working on mostly writing right now. I do public talks now and then, but people can find out by just going to skeptic.com or michaelshermer.com.
Okay, you be well.
Thank you.
All right, that's Michael Shermer. Make sure you're part of our entire Coast to Coast shows all week long for you. We've got some dandies. Culminating, of course, on Friday night with a special guest and some open lines as we go into a full moon Friday into Saturday morning on Coast to Coast AM. And don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.